Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What is it about life that is the older you get, the more time you spend looking back? Well, we found the same thing happens with podcasting. And as we've gotten better at this and our audience has gotten bigger, some of you might not have heard or found our early episodes. As we near 150 episodes, it can be a bit of a pain in the backside to scroll that far back in your app. So we're revisiting some of our early favorites, slightly edited, in a new regularly recurring series we call In Case You Missed It. Today we're going to dive into Van Halen Rising, how a Southern California backyard party band saved heavy metal. We have author Greg Renoff joining us. Welcome, Greg.
Thanks for having me on, Stephen. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book and to join this podcast.
So let me say from the outset, why a book on a world-famous band that actually ends when the band signs their first record contract? What intrigued you to write this?
I grew up a huge fan of Van Halen. I mean, people will write books on bands, and sometimes they sort of aren't big enthusiasts of it, but they think it's an interesting topic. It happened to be that I grew up a fan, and I was one of those guys who read every guitar magazine front to back. I was a guitar player and obsessed with Eddie Van Halen, but I was one of these individuals who never quite got past the intermediate level, so I was never very good, but nonetheless, I was a big reader. Articles went back and went to grad school, ended up getting a PhD in history, and one of the things that I ended up being really interested in is the band's beginnings. When I would kind of go back and revisit my fandom of Van Halen, I'd find that you could find a lot of information about the band's history post-1978, as you might imagine, once they became famous. But there would be all these stories or clips of little interviews that you would see where one of the guys in the band would be talking about a backyard party, or someone else would be talking about the Starwood and Gene Simmons. And I just got interested in the topic and kind of thinking about how did this band get started. And I decided I wanted to try to do a prehistory of the band and kind of try to take the approach that if you're a fan of Van Halen, you probably know enough about the main outlines of the band's history after 1978 that you probably think you know enough, whereas the early period you didn't know as much. And to be honest with you, once I started to do the interviews, I did over 200 interviews for the book, I had so much material that I had to try to find a way so that it wasn't 500 pages long. And so I decided to say, you know what, I'm just going to end it with their breakthrough. That's a high point. And it kind of, that was the goal for those guys in 1976, obviously, was not to, not necessarily to play stadiums, but supposed to get a record deal and just get on the map. And so that's what they had done. And so that was why I stopped it there.
Well, it's a fascinating story. And as you mentioned, these backyard parties that the LA kids had during the period, they're just completely off the hook. It's a huge part of their story, don't you think?
You know, I think the thing I didn't really realize until I got into writing the book is that the backyard parties were in a lot of ways essential for those guys breaking through. Because in 1976, 1975, 1974, I mean, nobody outside of LA had ever heard of Van Halen. But what ended up happening was that because Van Halen had gigged so extensively in and around Pasadena and the San Gabriel Valley, they play Altadena, they play Glendale, they play all these different cities in people's backyards or at high school dances. When they finally kind of had some momentum going, they were playing on the Sunset Strip. One of the things they ended up doing was they were playing at a place called the Pasadena Civic, which is still there on Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena. It was a kind of a general use building, and they would have concerts there, and they were working with little promoters and doing these shows. But what was happening was that they were able to draw 2,500, 3,000 people. And in fact, when Marshall Burrell, who was their first manager, and then Ted Templeman and other people who were involved with getting the band signed to Warner Brothers went to these concerts, they were just amazed that this unsigned band could attract 2,500 kids right in L.A. where, you know, there were bands playing at the Santa Monica Civic that were drawing half of that had major label deals and stuff like that. So the groundwork that those guys did for years to build a following in Pasadena was, I think, really essential to getting people who were in the music industry right before Van Halen got signed to sort of say, this is for real. This is legit that these guys have this type of enthusiasm on a local level.
And, you know, what a great way for a band to woodshed, you know, test their strengths, find out what works, what doesn't work. It's certainly a message to all the bands out there. Is there anything around similar these days, or are these things just a thing of the past?
You know, I think the thing is with backyard parties is that it's just not feasible to have that type of thing go on. I think it was kind of a moment that was a bunch of factors that came together. First of all, you had the Woodstock phenomenon, where you had everything from Altamont to Woodstock to all the festivals that went on up north in San Francisco. There was sort of a sense that this was a thing to do if you liked rock music, was to go to a festival and kind of come together with a huge group of people. And what ended up happening actually in Pasadena was that you had a couple of communities, particularly like San Marino, which was a very wealthy community buttressed against Pasadena, where there were these huge houses and these kids had these parties and they had space that was, you know, a couple of football fields in size, some of these backyards. I mean, they're crazy big, some of these backyards, because these were mansions. And so you have this Woodstock mentality, and yet that people who want to put on these parties with their friends, you also have the sort of social permission of, you know, teenage drinking and driving. It was, you know, kind of the Dazed and Confused era was not quite kind of looked upon with the same sort of hostility necessarily that would be in later decades. And so there was a little bit less of a policing of that kind of behavior. And so there was sort of a ability to get away with this to some degree.
Yeah, it's possible, too, that maybe parents just got wise to all this when they went away and they'd come back and their place was trash. So, but so in a nutshell, Red Ball Jet, that was David Lee Roth's band, right? And Mammoth was Eddie and Alex's band. And they were very competitive and played against each other, so to speak. And suddenly Roth says he wants in with the brothers, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm proudest of about the book is that I did dig so deep with Red Ball Jet. Now, Red Ball Jet is obviously a tiny, tiny footnote in rock and roll history. This was Roth's band. When I looked at this band and I ended up interviewing three of the guys who were in the band with Roth, you kind of could see a lot of Roth's ideas that he would bring to the table in the 80s as Van Halen got bigger were ones he wanted to do in 1972, 73 in high school. Great stories about Red Ball Jet was they tried to audition at this nightclub in Hollywood, and Roth wanted the guys to do sort of Motown step, sort of like, you know, Wilson Pickett's Brass Section would do. He wanted him to do this. And so you had this funky Rolling Stones style. Again, these are high school kids. Let's keep this in perspective, with David Lee Roth singing nonetheless, competing for backyard party gigs with a band called Mammoth, which was Eddie, Alex, and a bassist called Mark Stone. Eddie and Alex were cut from a very different musical cloth than Roth in a lot of ways. They were much more into Black Sabbath, kind of the proggy heavy metal, Captain Beyond. They would play, you know, some Zeppelin, some Who, but they were much more interested in sort of straightforward heavy metal, hard rock at the time, where Roth had much more of a Black Latino influences, you know, more Santana, that type of thing that Roth was more into. And so there was these different types of vibes. And of course, the other thing the Van Halen brothers had was they were far superior musicians than anything that Red Ball Jet had. So it was a very different type of thing. But yes, they had this competition. Eventually, Red Ball Jet sort of fell apart, and Roth was looking for another band, and he saw the Van Halen brothers and just gravitated to them like a moth to the flame. He wanted to partner with those guys because he could see the musical talent.
But he failed a couple of auditions initially, didn't he?
He did. The thing that I really took away from more than anything else about writing Van Halen Rising was how hard Roth worked to get himself in a position where he could become a rock star when that was his dream. Roth would tell you himself he's not a natural singer. He was never a guy who was going to be an Ian Gillan, for example, or a Robert Plant. He just doesn't have that type of vocal talent. And yes, the first couple times he auditioned for the brothers, they turned him down. And kind of took Lee in turning him down, kind of, this guy sucks, he's no good, he's a weirdo, that type of thing. But eventually, partially because Roth was very savvy in how he presented himself to those guys, and eventually because they saw that they needed a lead singer, and hey, look, Roth has some definite lead singer qualities, they could see that were good. He brought girls around, he knew how to get a crowd going, he was...
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycom order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The outgoing extrovert, where Eddie and Alex were definitely not like that naturally. So they sort of, I think, kind of overlooked some of the other issues, just decide that, yes, Roth has a PA system. As we all famously know, that was one of the incentives that Roth offered. He's like, I have this PA system, you guys need it. But also that Roth was a person who could take the frontman role away from Eddie Van Halen, who was singing, who was a guy who was so shy. People would tell me that he had this long hair at the time, that he would actually a lot of times just sing and his hair would sort of hang down in front of his face. He'd be singing to the microphone and, you know, wouldn't even push his hair out of his face because it was sort of, that was, you know, the kind of a barrier almost. Like, he didn't, you know, he was very shy and was not comfortable performing to any real extent. So he just kind of went into himself when he played, which was not something that would be engaging necessarily in the way that Roth was engaging.
And after Roth joined the band, they started to do other kind of unique gigs. You know, they played for free on the steps of the Pasadena City Hall, famously hosting wet t-shirt contests and dive bars. So my question is, how do these radically different gigs and then the backyard parties help shape the band?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that really worked for those guys, and I think worked for a lot of the bands of the era who were out there working as working bands, was that they had to play a lot of, first of all, top 40. To be able to play in clubs at the time, you couldn't go in there and play Inagata De Vida for 45 minutes at a nightclub. You had to play the hits of the day. So you were in a situation where you had to learn everything from ZZ Top to Motown to anything that was on the charts that people liked. You had to learn how to do it. And so what these guys ended up doing was they would play everything from biker bars, where they would play, you know, more like Fog Hat and stuff like that, where they would go to other places in town where they had to play, again, a much more straightforward 70s top 40 stuff. And I think what that really did, beyond those guys building up their chops, I think it was a unbelievable opportunity to learn what makes for a hit song. When you sit there and you're playing number one hit after top 10 hit in front of crowds, I think you, as songwriters, should start to go, oh, this is how you build a hit. This is what a great song is. So you're playing the Beatles, you're playing Led Zeppelin, you're playing all of these bands from a whole range of different genres, that from pop to harder rock, where people kind of go, wow, this is great, I love dancing to this. But at the same time, as a musician, you're learning what you need to do. And so I look ahead to 1977 and working with Ted Templeman, who was a guy who was had a very successful track record as a producer and knew how to craft hits. Those guys had already kind of figured out how to take their hard rock sound and make it poppy. which is what Van Halen 1 really was, taking the heavier parts of heavy metal, the solos, the Deep Purple screams, to the Ritchie Blackmore solos, for lack of a better term, to the Black Sabbath riffs, and making it something that could be played on the radio that was catchy, like Feel Your Love Tonight, which has basically like Beach Boys harmonies to it. So, I mean, that to me, playing all those different things, you kind of learn how to appeal to different crowds, but also they just learned the repertoire was upwards of 200 songs. I mean, you definitely are going to learn a lot about songwriting when you have to know how to play 200 songs.
And of course, there's probably not a better suited MC for wet t-shirt contests than David Lee Roth. I think that formed his personality as well.
That was one of the most fun parts of the book for me to write as well. I actually ended up interviewing the guy who owned this club, which is called the Long Since Gone. It was in Van Nuys, California, called the Rock Corporation. It was in a kind of an industrial, seedy neighborhood of Van Nuys. Basically, the deal was they were not making enough money to keep the club going. The club owner and one of the guys had been to, you know, some sort of party or something, and had seen a wet t-shirt contest. And one of the guys who worked for him was like, we should do this. And the guy was like kind of desperate. He was like, okay. And it went on for a few weeks until it was busted. But yes, Roth absolutely reveled in this. And again, this is one of those things that at the time, I think when you have a guy like Roth who can just naturally fall into that role and could have understood that, hey, this is perfect publicity for our band. Basically, like they jumped at the chance to do this. I mean, some bands might have been like, nah, don't want to do that. But those guys actually jumped at the chance to do something like that, to be around all these bikers, which was at times, from what I understood from reading interviews with those guys, not the most comfortable situation. As Alex Van Halen famously said, you know, like, they're basically like, if you don't play this song again, I'm going to wrap a chain around your neck while you play the drums, and then you're going to play the song. The crowds were intimidating and they were rough, and these guys yet kind of reveled in it and said, yeah, we'll definitely play for a crowd full of Hell's Angels in a wet t-shirt contest in a bad neighborhood in Van Nuys.
And then they move up to Gazzari's, which they were the house band at on Sunset Strip, and that was sort of out of fashion at the time, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, so the thing about Gazzari's is that as a child of the 80s, I heard a lot about Gazzari's from bands like Warrant and Poison and these other bands that would play there. And it was sort of a landmark at that point for 80s glam metal, for lack of a better term. And at the time, though, in the 70s, Gazzari's had sort of passé. In the late 60s, it was on, you know, something that'd be like TV shows filmed at Gazzari's. It was a place where you would have the Gazzari's dancers. It was sort of this go-go dancing place. But by 73, 74, it was, I wouldn't say that, but it was a place that if you were a real band that was trying to get somewhere, you wouldn't play there because it was a dead end. You could only play covers at Gazzari's. You couldn't really play original music. And so no record company executive was going to go to Gazzari's and go, hey, these guys play ZZ Top, or they play whatever. They're doing a really amazing job playing this BTO song, so I'm going to sign them to a record deal. You know, it was not a place where you could showcase your originals, which was actually a record deal. So it was sort of seen as this, you know, you got paid almost nothing down the block from the Whiskey, but it was worlds away from a place where the biggest bands in the world would play at the Whiskey when they would come to LA. Whereas bands like Gazzari's, you just walk three blocks away and it was like another planet where these bands were going nowhere.
You're listening to All Music Podcasts, a member of Pantheon Media. And they do finally make the Whiskey, and that's a stop that every band has to make on their way up. And it's right about this time that they start getting some notice from Rodney Bingenheimer, the legendary club owner, and then members of the all-girl group Runaways were big fans.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that was really important also to think about with Roth. I mean, you know, the band was great, so the music kind of spoke for itself. But I think Roth was a guy who knew how to work these people. He was the guy who I think was kind of instrumental in getting Rodney Bingenheimer interested, kind of talking to Rodney. I know it was because Rodney talked about it, that basically Rodney actually saw them at Gazzari's and was like, these guys are pretty good. And he's like, you know, kind of talked to them after the show. He's like, you know, hey, you have any original songs? Like, I like your band. And Roth talked to them, and eventually Bingenheimer was the guy who got them an audition at the Starwood, the infamous Starwood Club, which is, again, a place where you could play original music, but and was a step up from Gazzari's, but still wasn't the Whiskey. And then later, the thing I love about the story with Bingenheimer is that when Gene Simmons tries to get Van Halen a record deal and is unsuccessful, Van Halen has to come back to L.A. from New York with a tail between their legs, basically saying, hey, Gene Simmons didn't get us a deal, and he's the biggest rock star in America. But Rodney Bingenheimer had Van Halen on the radio, had Roth on the radio playing the demo for Running with the Devil. And if you listen on YouTube to the clip of that radio conversation, someone recorded it. Roth doesn't talk about it. They didn't get a record deal. He's like, we got this demo. We went to New York and recorded this demo, and and Rodney's like, oh yeah. You know, Rodney was a hype guy, and Roth kind of used his charisma and his ability to sort of be the rock star before he really was a rock star to get Rodney engaged. And to Rodney's credit, Rodney saw the talent.
And that was the Kiss manager, Bill Acoin, right? Who you're talking about that turned them down?
Right. So famously, the story is that Bill Acoin saw those guys in New York. Basically, Gene Simmons did a demo tape with them. He wanted to sign them to, correctly, Gene's plan was he wanted to do a kind of a Kiss subsidiary label, much like the Beatles had Apple. He wanted the Kiss to have a record label where they would have bands on this label, and they would take a cut of it. So he brought them to New York, and he showed them to Bill Acoin, and they auditioned at SIR Studios in New York City on Kiss's equipment. So Eddie's trying to play through Ace's guitar rig. Alex is trying to play through Peter's drums, and it didn't go particularly well. They were out of their element. And so the story continues the next day or two. Acoin said, well, come in and see me. And then basically said, hey, you guys have no commercial potential. Hey, maybe Eddie and Alex could do something with you guys. You guys seem to have some musical ability, but Dave, I mean, you know, I just don't think you're any good, basically. Basically, in front of all of those guys in his Madison Avenue office, told the band, yeah, Roth's kind of the weak link. I mean, he was very honest, apparently brutally honest, and you can imagine how rough that was for Roth. Yeah, that was November of 1976, and then February of 1977, Ted Templeman sees them at the Starwood, and the rest is history. They get a record deal with Warner Brothers.
But Simmons' motives weren't entirely pure either, right? He had the brothers play on Love Gun, was it, or Christine 16, without David Lee Roth, and there's rumors that that is them on the finished track, right?
Yeah, I mean, so Gene has released the finished track on the box set. I've actually heard them, and I think that the rumor can be put to rest, which was something that was whispered about by people who were in Van Halen's camp who saw the session and basically then later heard the recordings and think maybe that Eddie's solo ended up on the record, meaning Love Gun, but it's not. It's a different solo, but nonetheless, yes. Yeah. So after Gene comes back from touring with Kiss, and this is April 1977, Van Halen already has a record deal with Warner Brothers. Gene calls up Eddie and Alex and says, hey, would you guys play on some demos? I'm going to be at Village Recorder Studios in LA here. Would you come and play on the demos? And they do. Roth was always extremely suspicious of the fact. I mean, basically from the get-go, once Gene was sort of still calling Eddie and Alex, he was very suspicious that he wanted to steal those guys away, Kiss or something, which I kind of find not plausible. But nonetheless, I can understand why Roth would be worried that someone was going to try to take those guys away from him. You know, his motives may not have been totally pure, but I don't think in 1977, when Kiss is the biggest band in the world, that Gene and Paul were going to like, we'll put these two unknown guys in the band. And
yeah, that would come much later when Kiss would do that. One of the things that I love about your book, as far as rock prototypes or even stereotypes go, I don't know if you could craft a better lead singer than David Lee Roth, a better frontman, or a better lead guitarist as Eddie Van Halen. They were just perfect, you know, and they obviously grew into that role. In your book, obviously, which is a prehistory, very, very early on, you could see those characteristics of those two in particular.
Yeah, and I think the thing, too, as a rock historian, a fan of Van Halen, I mean, it was always a given that Eddie Van Halen had this enormous talent and that Van Halen never could have been Van Halen without Eddie's guitar playing. I mean, that was kind of a given. But one of the things I thought was really illuminating as I did the interviews was I talked to people who were, I mean, right there when this was going on, people who were friends with Roth, who threw backyard parties, who hung out with these guys after high school, 76, 75, and talked about how Roth was continually trying to get Eddie to kind of get out of his shell. One of those great stories I loved was one of the guys who hung around Roth all the time talked about how Eddie was, I guess, famous for cutting his own hair. You know, they sort of like this, the Jeff Spicoli uneven haircut, like, you know, just cutting it in the mirror. Those guys didn't have a lot of money, and so they would cut their own hair. And so Roth eventually got Eddie to go get a haircut at a salon. I guess this was like a huge, huge deal that Eddie was going to do this. And so Roth prepped all the guys in this circle of friends to be like, when Eddie comes around, be sure you say his hair looks good. Be serious. And like all those guys are like, oh, you look great. Like kind of trying to get him to kind of take on that rock star identity. From moving on stage, Roth would talk, get those guys to move. I mean, Eddie would stand stock still, not moving. He's like, you got to move. You got to jump. You got to, you know, got to, the music has to sound like it looks. We need you guys, meaning Michael and Eddie, to be more frenetic on stage. And got Eddie to do that. And so to me, yeah, I mean, Roth sort of grew into the role, but I think Roth from the start had sort of had the vision for what he wanted Van Halen to be like in some sense, where I think Eddie had to be brought along to what we saw in 1978 later with the incredible stage shows and the athletic type of performance that they would put on.
There's a great quote in your book, and it's obviously a very deeply researched book, but there's a guy who recalls seeing Eddie play. And the quote was, I was standing around with a bunch of guitar players while Eddie was playing, and you could tell the guitar players were the ones with their mouths open. And I think that perfectly encapsulates, you know, his skill set at such a young age.
And the quote that you read is from Tracy G, who was in Dio in the early 90s, and they were a little bit younger than Eddie Van Halen, so they would go to these parties and go to these clubs and see. And Tracy was great because, you know, had the mind of a guitar player, and we'd be like, yeah, he was like basically telling me these stories. He'd say that he would practice super hard. He'd say, maybe I've gotten a little bit closer. And then he said he would go to the whiskey, and Eddie Van Halen had started using the tremolo bar. Eddie had not really used a tremolo bar. It had always been sort of a Les Paul-style fixed bridge. And so Tracy'd be like, damn, you know, now he's like doing these incredible things with the whammy bar. And Tracy was amazed. And so Tracy sort of went back and sort of was practicing more. And then in like a few weeks later, he goes back and sees that Eddie is doing the eruption style two-handed tapping where he's really perfected it. And basically Tracy's like, never going to catch this guy. Just that, he said that was constantly what it was, that Eddie always was kind of pushing, you know, Randy Rhoads, George Lynch, all these guys who were on the scene who were good guitar, very good professional guitar players who went on to great success were going to be a step behind Eddie.
I have to say, David Lee Roth, I think, comes across really, really well in your book. Much is made of his well-to-do background, but, you know, he was out in front promoting the band and working on their style and maybe pushing Eddie to be more of a front man. I mean, that guy worked his ass off, didn't he?
Yeah, one of the real interesting things about Roth is Roth came from this background where his father purchased the house that Roth lives in now in Pasadena, this 20-room Italianate mansion, which is like basically a historic landmark. I mean, it's this incredible house. So you can imagine that Eddie and Alex are living in a two-bedroom house in Pasadena, tiny, kind of a galley kitchen. I mean, it would be one of these post-World War II houses that you'd walk into today that people would probably scrape. They'd be like, I don't want to live in this house. It's too small. And then, you know, they end up with this guy who comes from this incredible privilege in some sort of way. But yeah, Roth, I mean, again, Roth really got down and did the stuff. I mean, you know, hauling the gear. Roth never set himself apart in that sort of ways. And he deserves a tremendous amount of credit because he put himself, as you said, into the business of promoting and working it without falling back on, well, you know, I could just live off my dad for the rest of my life. And Roth really was not wanting to do that. He wanted to make it on his own. And so the other thing I would say, of course, is that the house itself was advantageous because it gave those guys a place to practice. So they woodshedded and wrote songs in the basement, and told by a number of people, from Pete Angelus, who was Roth's right-hand man in his solo career and had been with Van Halen since 1977, that you could go in the house there in Pasadena and be standing in the kitchen. This is Roth's mansion, and you could barely hear what was going on in the basement. The basement was so like densely concreted. The roof was, you know, they had like a concrete roof and a concrete floor. So it was like almost like a crypt down there. So it was, you know, a place where you could practice around the clock. And those guys had this workspace where they could really do that, along with the, you know, on the fact that they had a guy like Roth, who again was right there with those guys willing to work.
The last David Lee Roth story, your book is full of them. And, you know, they say payback is a bitch. And I know that Van Halen, after they got huge, David Lee Roth got a little bit of payback on Simmons regarding backstage passes.
One of the things that comes full circle is that, I believe in August 1977, if I remember correctly, Kiss is playing at the Forum with Cheap Trick. And this is the peak Kiss moment. So very hard to get tickets. Gene, to say thank you to Van Halen, says, I've left tickets for you guys. Kind of passes the word to Eddie and Alex. Left tickets. Come on down. So Eddie and Alex bring their dates, and Roth went down to the Forum. And then supposedly the story is there were tickets left for some of the guys in Van Halen, but not for Roth. Basically, they're like, no, there's no ticket with an envelope that says David Lee Roth on it. So 1977. So Roth sulks away, obviously, from the Forum, humiliated. And so 1984 rolls around, and Van Halen is coming to the Forum. This is now, Van Halen is the biggest band in the world, and Kiss is sort of an also-ran in the world of rock. And so I guess Roth called Gene's office, hey, if you want, come on down to the forum. I got tickets for you. You know, come down or whatever. I'll let you in. And so Gene went down there, and when Gene got there, there were no tickets for Gene Simmons. So that was the payback. Yeah.
Classic. Well, his book is Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. I'd like to thank Greg Renoff for showing up and fill us in on these stories. This is the book that Van Halen fans want to read. I've read it. You may think, well, it ends right when I want to know about all the good stuff. This is the good stuff. It's a great book. Great job, Greg, and thanks for coming on.
Hey, no problem. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, thanks for going backwards in time with us for this episode of In Case You Missed It. We're going to try and keep this going every other week. And don't forget, if your app only shows you 20 episodes or so at a time, check out our brand new mobile-friendly website, allmusicpodcast.com. where all of our shows are instantly available at your fingertips.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.